Chapter 5. Reading the Mood. An athlete or artist who is in the zone is flawless in her performance because when she is absorbed in an objective, her attention is solely on what needs to be done. Likewise, a confident person is able to focus outwardly on the objective, and the I disappears, just as the linguistic I does. Of course, sometimes it makes sense to be hyper-focused on yourself. Note how you usually take the first sip from a hot, steaming cup of coffee or tea. Your level of concentration is intense. You move slowly, watching the cup as it comes to your lips, and then haltingly, hesitatingly, taste the brew. Your behavior indicates the stakes. As interest increases, in this instance, not wanting to scald oneself, a chain reaction ensues. Confidence decreases as the risk is greater. Perspective narrows as the ego engages and we become fearful. And anxiety increases because the ego needs to feel in control. This chain reaction isn't specific to hot beverages. If you know what to look for, confidence, or the lack thereof, is easy to spot. The psychology of confidence. If you were asked to walk along a wide painted line on the floor, you would do so with complete ease. You might glance down to get your bearings, only to look up and around as you move across the room. You'd probably check a ringing phone and speak or joke with abandon. Asked to do the same task on a narrower line, your attention would increase significantly. Now, take the same thin line and place it on a plank 20 stories high. You would walk slowly, paying attention to each step and focusing on nothing else, certainly not using the phone or taking in the view. You would be entirely self-focused because of the higher stakes of physical safety. The same thing is true of emotional safety. How can you tell who feels like they are walking on the ground and who feels like they are 20 feet in the air? The person paying more attention to himself is the one who feels more anxious. Let's look more deeply at the process. There are 4 stages to a person's actions. 1. Unconscious incompetence is when a person is unaware that he is not performing correctly. 2. Conscious incompetence is when a person is aware that he has not acquired the skill set necessary to be as effective and successful as he would like to be. 3. Conscious competence is when a person is aware of what he needs to do, but awareness is needed in order to be effective. And 4. Unconscious competence is when a person can perform correctly and as necessary without his full or even partial attention. Learning to drive a stick shift car effectively illustrates the 4 levels. At first, it feels completely foreign, but the driver eventually has the skill to shift gears without consciously focusing on what she is doing. The process is now integrated into muscle memory and can be instinctually performed. Muscle memory is related to procedural memory, which is a type of unconscious long-term memory that helps us perform specific tasks with minimal attention. We can automatically access procedural memories without conscious awareness. Similarly, note the contrast between a new driver and a seasoned pro. The former gets behind the wheel and checks everything. His gaze locks onto the gear shift as he puts the car into reverse. His head tilts downward as he slowly releases the clutch and puts his foot on the gas. One thing at a time. There is no buckling the seatbelt while backing up or twisting open the cap of a soft drink while steering with his knee. But what happens to our seasoned driver when we introduce a stressor, a snowstorm with 0 visibility? He turns off the radio. His hands grip the wheel at the recommended position of 8 o'clock and 4 o'clock. Psychologically, higher stakes narrow our perspective, increase our anxiety, and reorient our focus. During a casual conversation with an employee, you notice they reach for a can of soda well within their grasp. They watch their hand extend to the drink. Then they watch their hand as it moves the can up to their lips. Your employee is feeling insecure and does not trust themselves to do what they have done hundreds of thousands of times previously without paying attention. This shows a higher level of anxiety than a casual and presumably friendly encounter would indicate. Whether in a meeting, on a date, or in an interrogation, the person who feels nervous is hyper-aware of everything they say and do. Their demeanor may be stiff, their movements and gestures awkward and mechanical. What were once unconscious actions become part of a heightened state of awareness. The anxious tells. If you've ever blanked in a moment of stress or choked under pressure, increased self-focus is the culprit. A normally automatic or unconscious activity is disrupted by consciousness of it or reflection on it, and as the stakes get higher, the anxiety increases and our cognitive faculties become increasingly compromised. The result? Performance suffers. Because anxiety shifts our focus to the self, our ability to absorb new information is also diminished. Have you ever met someone at a party and forgotten her name right after you were introduced? Likewise, when we are nervous, we take things more literally. Our brain is busy scanning for observable threats, and while it tries to get its bearings, we often cannot process other information beyond a superficial level. In the face of any threat, physical or emotional, we are on high alert, and the cognitive resources required to make tangential connections are diverted elsewhere. Accordingly, in the face of a threat, we often have trouble processing humor, particularly sarcasm. To recognize a sarcastic comment, we have to perceive the contradiction between the surface level, literal, meaning, and the intended meaning. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, is required to integrate the literal meaning with the speaker's intended message. Because anxiety or anger causes the brain to engage the more primitive amygdala, the emotion response center, our response time is slowed. We first have to bring the thinking brain back online before we can understand the connotation or inference. What does this look like in real life? The anxious person misses the sarcasm and stares blankly or laughs nervously before catching on. Physical manifestations of anxiety. Self-conscious manifestations also include fidgeting, touching our face and hair, picking at our skin, rubbing our leg, and playing with our fingers. Watch for the following signs of intense anxiety or fear. 1. A person's face becoming flushed or turning white from extreme fear. Look for rapid breathing and increased perspiration. In addition, take note of whether he is trying to control his breathing to calm himself. His efforts to remain calm will appear as deep, audible inhaling and exhaling. 2. Trembling or shaking in voice or body. His hands may tremble. If he's hiding his hands, it might be an attempt to hide uncontrollable shaking. His voice may crack and seem inconsistent. 3. Difficulty swallowing, hence the expression all choked up. Television or movie actors who wish to express fear or sadness often use this behavior. Throat clearing is also a sign of nervousness. Anxiety causes mucus to form in the throat. A public speaker who is nervous often clears his throat before speaking. And 4. Vocal changes. Vocal cords, like all muscles, tighten when a person is stressed, producing a higher sound, octave, or pitch. The language of anxiety. Because emotional distress orients our attention inward, the frequent use of personal pronouns is a hallmark of an anxious state. Not all pronouns are created equal. The personal pronoun me indicates inward orientation, as does the pronoun I, but because it almost always is used in a passive tense, whereby something acts on the person rather than the person taking action, me is indicative of feelings of helplessness and vulnerability. And when me is used superfluously, the anxiety rings ever more loudly. For instance, my stomach hurts versus my stomach hurts me. Why are you yelling versus why are you yelling at me? Because anxiety and anger are inextricably linked, an angry state is also associated with me language. In both states, the person sees himself as a victim, triggering him to use me language. For example, how could you do this to me? An anxious state is also easy to spot by the frequent use of qualifiers, which are expressions of uncertainty or indecisiveness. For example, I think, I wonder, or I guess. The use of qualifiers increases with a person's anxiety and usually comes before the completed verb, diluting a speaker's conviction in her statement. When you know something is true, you do not find it necessary to buttress your confidence to either yourself or another person. For example, barring an existentialist dilemma, you would not say, I believe I exist. You know you exist and therefore state the truism without qualification. I exist. Imagine you're suffering from an uncomfortable skin rash and make your way to the dermatologist. After a thorough exam, she hands you a prescription and says either, this medication will help, or I think this medication will help. Which would you rather hear? Qualifiers erode conviction rather than reinforce it. All this said, it is only when expressing subjective, not objective, information, for example, an opinion, preference, or desire, that the use of a qualifier signals insecurity or uncertainty. See Chapter 10 for elaboration. The challenge in decoding the syntax is further complicated by repressed anxiety. We will see later that narcissists, for example, compensate for deep-seated insecurities with definitive rather than tentative speech. To accurately detect a person in an anxious state, you will want to observe a qualifier in conjunction with another marker, a linguistic retractor. For example, but, although, however, or nevertheless. This language pattern cements the presence of anxiety because, like qualifiers, retractors speak to tentativeness, the former before the action, the latter after the action. Retractors and qualifiers disclose deliberation and indecision. Effectively, they are laying an escape plan into any forward movement. For example, I think that this could be okay, but I don't know. Or, I guess it might make sense, so I could try it, although. This indicates not only a state of anxiety, but also the possible presence of its blood relative, trait obsessiveness, and fear of vulnerability, risk, or failure. Additionally, negations, for example, no, not, or never, and negativity, for example, fail, bad, or poor, are associated with increased anxiety and insecurity. The same situation can be framed either through a positive or negative lens. In other words, a person who says, there's a chance it may work, or it's possible we may succeed, likely feels more confident or has less at stake than one who says, this will probably fail, or it's not likely to work. It's important to distinguish traits from states. In other words, you want to determine whether someone is behaving a certain way because of who they are at the core, or whether they're simply reacting to a particular situation. A state is a temporary way of feeling. It reflects our thoughts or responses to the current situation. A trait is a more stable characteristic or pattern of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and thus serves as a valuable predictor of future behavior. Someone with an anxiety trait, for instance, is primed to perceive a safe situation as threatening and is predisposed to react with heightened and disproportionate anxiety. Intuitively, a person who worries a lot over trivial matters, a trait, is more likely to become tense in any given situation, a state. To confirm whether you are observing a trait or a state, or both, we want to now take note of frequency, duration, intensity, and context. More on this in parts 3 and 4. Poker Corner. Nervous betting often accompanies a strong hand because the player feels a great deal of tension. This is it, big time! He has to make sure that he capitalizes on it and doesn't choke. Interestingly, and counterintuitively, a person who is bluffing will often appear more casual for two reasons. First, he is managing his impression and wants to make sure that he comes off as nonchalant and unworried. But second, and more psychologically profound, he is in control. He can bet, raise, or fold. He makes the choice to bluff, and this control makes him feel more confident. The person with a strong hand has no legitimate choice other than betting, seeing, or raising. He can't fold, so the pressure is felt more intensely, not less so. Fear leads to anger. The lower our self-esteem in general, and how much the uncomfortable truth affects our self-image in particular, the more fearful we become. The ego tells us that we are vulnerable and in danger. Enter the fight-flight-freeze response, which is a physiological reaction to a perceived threat, physical or emotional. The sympathetic nervous system activates the adrenal glands, which release adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol into the bloodstream. This injection reroutes the body's reaction from the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala. A person who gets angry is, to some extent, fearful. The response to fear, the ego's attempt to compensate for the loss, is anger. Anger provides the illusion of control because, physiologically, the release of these substances increases awareness, energy, and strength. Emotionally, anger directs our attention away from ourselves, which also mimics the sensation that we are more secure. Let's look at a diverse set of circumstances that can lead to anger and see how the process unfolds in a consistently similar way. 1. Someone cuts you off on the road. Catalyst. You lose control of the situation as you had to swerve or hit your brakes in order to avoid an accident. This causes you to become scared, thinking of what might have happened. You then direct anger at the other driver. 2. Your child refuses to wear her warm jacket. Catalyst. You feel that you are not in control of the situation. You may become fearful that she does not respect you and will not listen to other things that you ask her to do. You then become angry with her for not listening to you. And 3. A person is rude to you. Catalyst. Depending on who it is, this act of disrespect may cause you to doubt yourself. To some extent, you may become fearful that he doesn't like or respect you, and this causes you to question your own self-worth and image. You become angry because the way you wish for others to treat and relate to you is different from how the situation is evolving. Our need to feel in control also extends to situations that have nothing to do with other people. For instance, 4. You trip over a chair in the dark. Catalyst. You lose control, meaning that your plan to walk from point A to point B without tripping was disrupted. This causes you to become scared, as you may have injured yourself. You then become angry. Interestingly, some people become angry at themselves, at the chair, kicking it, or even at the person who put it there for you to trip over. Logically, anger offers no real satisfaction or psychological comfort. It is our ego's defense mechanism to feeling vulnerable, yet we spiral out of control and become emotionally weaker with each intense, anger-driven thought or action. the language of anger. He says he's furious, but it may all be a show. She wrote to you that everything is fine, but you think she is secretly seething, planning, plotting. Even when a person is angry, it doesn't mean that he comes out swinging. An individual's unique personality will dictate his modus operandi. 1. Assertive-aggressive fight. He comes out fighting to control the situation, you, overtly. He knows that he's angry and isn't afraid to show it. 2. Passive-aggressive. Fight-flight. His anger leaks out in subtle ways. He knows he is angry but can't handle confrontation. Unable to confront directly, he seeks control stealthily. 3. Suppression-flight. He doesn't consciously acknowledge his anger, so he controls it by suppressing his emotions and telling himself that he isn't angry at all. 4. Immobilization. Freeze. He buries the anger. Feeling powerless, he closes down and insulates himself from the pain. He thinks, I can shut out the world. I will be safe. I will be in control. And 5. Surrender. Flight. He either tells himself that he isn't worthy of asserting himself, or that it's just not worth it. Grammatically speaking, an angry state is distinguished by the use of more second and third person pronouns. Remember, the first person is the I, me, my, mine, and myself perspective. The second person is the you, your, yours, and yourself perspective. The third person is the he, she, it, they, his, himself, hers, herself, their, and themselves perspective. A pronoun shift from first to second and third person makes perfect sense when you're angry. Emotionally, anger serves to channel, mask, or otherwise redirect our attention away from ourselves. The language we use follows the same path. Moving away from I and toward you notably predicts hostility and linguistic self-defense or deflection and signals the state of anger. Counterintuitively, an angry state does produce me language, even though the pronoun I is used less frequently. While the pronoun me is typically used to express passivity, whereby something or someone acted upon me, an angry person sees himself as a victim of some force, and thus is an object of unfair and undeserved mistreatment. For example, how dare you do this to me? Or, how could this be happening to me? Subsequently, an angry person will ask more rhetorical questions. These often occur in the form of rhetorical phrases. For example, what is your problem? What are you doing to me? Or, where'd you learn how to type? In this state, a person will also use fewer cooperative pronouns, such as we, us, and our, more swear words, and more negations. For example, no, not, or never, and negativity. For example, fail, loss, or hate. Overt anger, assertive-aggressive, is easy to recognize. When someone is screaming or scolding you, it's clear how they are feeling. But anger is not always expressed. Indeed, sometimes it is suppressed, conscious blocking of unwanted thoughts or impulses, or repressed, unconscious blocking altogether. An absence of qualifiers and retractors, an increase in concrete nouns, and a decrease in function words are reliable indicators of latent hostility. Because anger engages to embolden us, its language must be absolute and definitive. Think bold colors, not pastels. If qualifiers and retractors define an anxious state, their absence identifies an angry state. Linguistic analysis shows a decreased use of both qualifiers and retractors by a latently hostile person. Note how statement A strikes an authentic note, while statement B feels middling, almost comical. Statement A. I'm furious with you for even thinking you could steal from me. Statement B. I believe, qualifier, I'm furious with you for even thinking you could do that to me, although, retractor. Unqualified language also means an increase in the use of concrete nouns and a decrease in function words. An angry person uses direct and unequivocal language because she does not want any misunderstanding. This means sentences with exact pronouns and proper nouns, that is, names and places. For example, I told Jim 3 times not to let the accountant into the executive suite. Rather than, I told him a few times not to let him back here. The meaning of the first sentence is unambiguous and does not rely on shared knowledge or perspective. As we learned, in an angry state, the ego is fully engaged. Just as our language does not contain the words us and we do not want to connect or share anything with the person or object of our disdain. No matter how calmly spoken, or how delicately written with smiley face emoticons, there is an assumption of latent anger, or at least bubbling frustration within the situation. In face-to-face interactions, be aware that a smile is the most common mask for emotion because it best conceals the appearance in the lower face of anger, disgust, sadness, or fear. In other words, a person who doesn't want her true feelings to be exposed may put on a happy face. A smile that's genuine lights up the whole face. When a smile is forced, the person's mouth is closed and tight, and there's no movement in the eyes or forehead. This is similar to that of someone who is embarrassed by a joke, but wants to pretend that she thinks it's funny. What you see is a lips-only smile, not a big grin encompassing her entire face. As we learned throughout Part 1, when it comes to thoughts and feelings, the emotional landscape regarding intention is not always clear. A person may be sincere even though they're feeling insecure, or they don't think they are lying to you because in actuality, they are lying to themselves and believe what they say. In Part 2, the stakes are higher and the tactics sharper because it's crystal clear. Here, it's you against them. And the question is this someone who will give you the shirt off his back? Or, if given the chance, will he look to stab you in the back?